your hosts, Jen Mac-Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Before we get into this week's installments of What Baseball Means to Me, we've got to talk about the two big baseball news items. The two big-ticket players of the offseason have found landing spots. First up is Shohei Ohtani has picked the team, and it's the Angels? How surprising is this?
I mean,
surprising.
It seemed like of his list, the Angels were the team that got talked about least. Well, maybe the Padres were last, but like definitely one of the teams that people didn't really think were at the top of his list. But at the same time, like nobody really knows what he was looking for in a team. People kind of hypothesize that he might have chosen the Angels because they've never had a Japanese star for them before, so he can kind of be the first to create this legacy in Anaheim. So that might be it, but I don't know. It's all speculation.
Yeah, I would say that of the finalists, they definitely seem like the least likely landing spot. Like even with the Padres, there was the connection that Hideo Nomo is in their front office, and Nomo's son is Ohtani's translator. So even they have, you know, something going for them, where the Angels really didn't have anything in particular that, you know, made them, you know, stand out as a choice. I guess based on what he wanted, which is, you know, a West Coast team, smaller market, which it feels weird to say that about a team with Los Angeles in their name, but they're not actually in Los Angeles. You know, they're in Anaheim, and that makes a difference. You know, they may be covered by LA media, but they definitely are like the younger brother role in the Dodgers Angels relationship. So between those two things and the fact that they're an American League team, and it gives them the opportunity to serve as a designated hitter, which is obviously something that's important to him, it makes sense, but it definitely was something that I don't think anybody would have, or at least any of the people who we trust to give us their opinions about baseball, would have picked, you know, at the very beginning of this entire process.
Yeah, I remember seeing a tweet, and I don't remember who it was from, but there was a tweet saying that, I don't know if it was deleted or not because I just went to look for it, but saying that the Angels were the only team that might have offered him the ability to both DH and pitch, which you would think that's a given if it's an AL team trying to make Ohtani an offer, but, you know, who knows. If that was really the case, then it's kind of a no-brainer that Ohtani would go to the team that would let him DH and on, you know, days where he's not pitching, but otherwise it just seems so outlandish that no other AL team would offer that.
Do you think that he will hit on days that he pitches, and therefore the Angels will forfeit the DH, because that could lead to some interesting things?
I don't know if that's something that Mike Socha would even consider.
I can see it. I think that they got him, you know, more for his arm than for his bat, but the bat is obviously a substantial part of it. So why not? Why not have him in your lineup if he, I mean, it may in part, like, if they continue doing it, it may in part depend on, you know, how his bat actually does translate to the majors. But I mean, if he's the best option to have in the lineup, then why wouldn't they do that?
Yeah, definitely. So what does Ohtani's addition mean for the Angels next year?
They have an actual good pitcher.
Yeah.
That is something that they needed, and they probably need at least a couple more because there's not a ton of guarantee with that Angels rotation as it stands right now. I mean, if Garrett Richards is actually able to stay healthy, that's a big if. The dude tore his UCL and didn't have Tommy John surgery, so like that whole thing is super weird. But if he can stay healthy, then he should be good because he's really good when he's healthy. But besides that, that rotation is, or even including that, that rotation is really messy. So this is definitely a start, but they got to do so much more. And that the rotation definitely stands out as the biggest weak spot, but they also have a few moves that they should make in terms of their lineup as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll be very fun for the baseball community as a whole to watch the Angels now that they have both Ohtani and Trout on the roster. Hopefully they both can stay healthy this season. So I think that will lead to a lot of great matchups with other teams, and it will just kind of make the Angels, you know, a little more exciting, a little more interesting to follow. And with the AL West, the Angels obviously have a lot of things that they still need to work on, but it seems like it's really a kind of still a toss-up division. So if they make another few moves and they can get the production that they expect out of Trout and Ohtani, then they could be in good shape to at least contend.
Yeah, I think they just really need to fix up that rotation a little bit more. I mean, obviously Ohtani is not going to be the end-all be-all in that rotation and that bullpen, especially since they're in the same division as the Houston Astros. It feels like the best that they could try to do if Houston doesn't run away with the division is try to go for a wild card spot. And my biggest concern is how much money they'd be able to spend on a cheap pitcher on the free agency market or trying to trade for a pitcher because their farm system is still depleted. It's very obvious what the Angels need, but the means to make it happen, that's the big question for the Angels now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that they stayed in contention for that wild card for the better part of the season, and that, of course, in part has to do with the fact that the American League outside of the division winners and the Yankees was pretty weak last year. But nonetheless, it suggests that they were, you know, maybe a couple of moves away from being able to get back into it. So I think that they'll definitely be competitive next year. Like you were saying, probably more likely for a wild card spot than for the division, but that could happen as well. You know, if the Astros have like a World Series hangover or something, that could definitely factor in. Another thing I think will be interesting to see is what this means for Albert Pujols, because he has 4 years left on that contract. He is slowing down considerably. I mean, he still has some power, but like just in terms of everything else, he looks very old out there. And you know, he's primarily serving as a DH now, but if they have Ohtani, then what does that mean for Pujols?
Yeah, and that's not really a contract that they can move, because they don't have nobody really wants Pujols, and they don't have anything really that they can throw in to kind of sweeten the deal a little bit. So I don't know if they're going to have Ohtani, like maybe try his luck in the outfield. if they want to. Like, I don't know what's going to happen there, but I don't know what else they can do with pool holes.
I mean, I guess they can slot him back in at first, but then what does that mean for CJ Krohn? I don't see that happening. And also the Angel said that, well, at least they said for now that they aren't planning to play Ohtani in the outfield, but things can always change.
Yeah. It just seems very, very unlikely that they'll let Pujols sit for 4 days or give or take while Ohtani is DHing, especially with how ridiculous Pujols' contract is at the moment. So we shall see where that goes. So next up, the Marlins have finally managed to trade Giancarlo Stanton. He's going to the Yankees along with $35 million in exchange for Starlin Castro and some prospects. So
I don't think anybody aside from Yankees fans are happy with this deal, either personally or what it means, you know, for the Marlins or for the state of baseball ownership. It just seems like it's completely a mess. I mean, good on the Yankees for getting him, like, whatever, who cares besides Yankees fans. Just a little angry, it's fine. Not angry at the Yankees for getting him, just angry at Jeter for his entire existence. Angry at the owners for allowing this group to buy the Marlins. Angry that they are going to slash the payroll until it gets to $55 million, which is completely ridiculous, and it's not going to help them be competitive in any way. And it's just a bad situation all around.
It really is remarkable that somehow things managed to get worse from Loria, and it's with Derek Jeter as the face of it. I mean, you know, we've talked about this privately about how, you know, Derek Jeter made his career basically on being a likable character and being a charismatic figure with the media. And he's just done this total heel turn where he just is the face of, like, utter incompetence. And it's just kind of been amazing to watch unfold. Because it's happened so quickly.
Yeah, and I remember seeing somewhere someone said, you know, while, you know, it's good that the Marlins are no longer under Loria's control, at least the Marlins under Loria's control had a semblance of what to do. And then there's Jeter and his ownership group, and they're just completely, like, they just make this entire process seem like a farce. And, you know, from Stanton trying, you know, from trying to trade Stanton, getting to the point where the Cardinals have to release a statement saying, you know, oh, we had a deal in place, but Stanton rejected, you know, the trade. And there are just so many aspects to it that could have been avoided, but instead it just became this huge spectacle.
Yeah, and it just seems, like, especially bad because so many Marlins fans really clung to and now there's nothing there left for them with the team. It's not going to be an enjoyable season in any way for them. And at least before they could kind of, you know, tune in to see how many home runs he would hit or, you know, how he would do as a whole. And so that's just very depressing for all of those people. And I think, you know, people are just kind of really questioning or marveling at their commitment to the team and, you know, questioning why they all haven't kind of jumped ship at this point.
Yeah, it just seems like Yeah, there are a lot of teams that have done fire sales in the past, but none so reckless that the way the Marlins are doing it right now, to the point where it doesn't necessarily seem like it's even trying to rebuild the team. I mean, yeah, it's good that, you know, the Marlins are able to offload a lot of Stanton's salary as well, but it's not like they're getting a Yoan Moncada in the deal. It's Starlin Castro and some prospects, and yeah, it's just, what are they getting in return? They're not even building up their farm system to be competitive in the future. And Stanton could have brought in such a huge prospect haul, and they're not even getting that.
Yeah, I would feel pretty hopeless right now if I were a Marlins fan. And it definitely feels like a betrayal. You know, it's like they are like, oh, finally we're getting rid of, you know, Loria, who just like totally ruined everything. And, oh, we're getting this new ownership group. And, oh, it's got the very trustworthy face of Derek Jeter. But, like, it took virtually no time for it to be revealed that Eddie Pope was false. I just wonder how long that this is going to be allowed to continue.
Yeah, I hope that it really kind of makes people question Major League Baseball as a whole and kind of press them on the issue and kind of starts a conversation around player salary and players' rights in the league.
Absolutely. And I think on more of a lighthearted note, one of the takeaways from this is that, you know, never trust the man who has that much hand sanitizer at his desk.
Yeah, that was a weird setup. And, like, for a staged photo, like, what are you trying to say about Jeter? Like, it's just that still. I mean, like, right then and there, it was really kind of clear that this was not going to be great.
It was ominous. But
two iPads and hand sanitizer, okay.
Yeah, it's like some weird commentary on like the dystopian future that we're living in. I don't know exactly what it's saying, but I know it's saying something bad.
Yeah, it's kind of spelling out doom for the Marlins. But, you know, especially, you know, Marlins also got rid of D. Gordon for the Mariners. They were more on the higher end of the prospect list, but they're kind of mid-level to top-level prospects in exchange for D. Gordon and some bonus money. So, you know, they're getting rid of any player who might have made the Marlins fun, and they're just going to be that team who plays in Florida at this point. So,
and we already have one of those.
It's just very sad to watch.
It is.
Now let's get to the second round of What Baseball Means to Me. As a refresher, during the offseason, we're going to be talking with women and NB baseball fans about their relationship with baseball and how the game has impacted their lives. All of our guests today have previously been on this podcast, and we're very excited to welcome them all back. First up is Isabel Manassian of Lookout Landing, La Vida Baseball, and of course, the Hardball Times. Isabel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to be talking to all of you again.
Yeah, we're very glad to have you back. Now, for anybody who perhaps missed that episode or doesn't remember, remind us of your favorite team and also give us your age.
My favorite team is the Seattle Mariners, for better or for worse, and I'm 22 years old.
So what first made you interested in watching baseball?
So I started out playing softball when I was pretty young. My mom is very much the main sports fan in our family and was actually one of the early beneficiaries of Title IX. So she was finally able, when she was like 9 or 10, to be able to play baseball with her brother. So that was the sport that I kind of grew up with. And it's one of those things where if you play the game, you're more likely to enjoy watching it, I think. It's been my struggle with football. I never got to play. So I don't understand the nuance in the same way, but baseball I know a little bit, and it's one of those sports that really grows on you.
It's probably a good thing that you never played football.
Yeah.
Baseball's definitely the better route to go.
Got those guaranteed contracts.
Yeah, yeah. And fewer head injuries, which is always a bonus. It just injures you in a different way. It's a very light episode. Is there any way that social media, specifically Twitter, has impacted your experience as a fan?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't join Twitter until, I guess, a month or two before I graduated from college, and was pretty loath to use social media at all. Felt like a very manufactured way of creating friendships. And now, a year and a half later, pretty much everything in my life has been influenced by Twitter, as horrendous as that may sound. But the fandom especially, I moved back to Seattle and most of my friends had moved away and felt pretty lonely. But I started writing for Lookout Landing. I joined Mariners Twitter in all its glory, and it let me start to build a community here, and the people I interacted with there, the people that I write with, have become some of my best friends. They helped me find the job that I'm working right now. It has changed all of my life. It's ridiculous, and I swear Twitter has not paid me to be a feel-good sponsor for them.
I mean, I think we all have had kind of similar experiences too of, you know, just kind of getting on there because it's the thing to do or whatever. And then being like, oh, wait, I actually am forming real connections with people and, you know, leading to legitimate professional opportunities. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of drawbacks of Twitter too. I think we're all pretty openly critical of a lot of things about the site, but it's definitely good to focus on what's positive about it, because there's a lot, like, we wouldn't stick around if we weren't getting something out of it, you know?
Exactly. I think one of the things that I've come to appreciate is that it makes it easier to join a conversation that you might not always be encouraged to be a part of in the real world. Like, the number of times I've tried to engage with a dude at a baseball game about baseball, and you don't get anywhere. And in the meantime, you can have the conversations that you're craving as a female fan on Twitter.
Yeah, plus it's pretty easy to go to someone's profile and see if there's someone you feel like you want to engage with. Like, if you go to someone's timeline and you see, you know, all sorts of terrible stuff about, you know, whatever, their bad opinions about politics or whatever, you can be like, okay, I can maybe avoid getting too involved here. But you go to someone and you see that they have really interesting and, you know, thoughtful opinions about things, you might be more inclined to be like, okay, this is someone that I can interact with and we can, you know, have a meaningful conversation that won't just end in us yelling at each other, you know, totally unconstructively.
Exactly. There's that vetting process. And the other side of things too is that sometimes people surprise you, and I've become friends with people that I never would have interacted with otherwise.
Yeah, that's a very cool thing. You know, I think it very much opens our worldview and our, you know, the people that we have access to. Now changing gears a little bit, what would you say that the most difficult thing about being a baseball fan has been for you?
I was talking about this actually, of course, because you sent great questions and I wanted to talk about them with someone else too. I was talking to a friend of mine and I don't think there's anything inherently difficult about being a baseball fan. I don't think that would have been my answer a year ago, but the 2016 or 2017 Mariners season was not wonderful. But 2017 has not been wonderful, and kind of realized, I guess, around June or July, we choose to watch baseball. Our careers, whether we like them or not, they're not intrinsically tied to this game. So if it's not making us happy, why are we still choosing to engage with this thing? So I don't necessarily at this point, there's not something about being a baseball fan that I find difficult per se. I think if I were to try and point out one thing, it would be maybe interacting with other fans sometimes. I think that the hive mind can be somewhat toxic. If there's a bad game, if there's a bad play, if Shohei Ohtani does not sign with your team, everything crumbles and one person's misery feeds another, and then you're looking through this pile of misery and you might not have felt bad about it, but all of a sudden you're reading everyone else's frustrations and you're like, yeah, this sucks, this is the worst, everything's done, we're screwed. And you've got to take a step back and recognize that's maybe not how I feel. It's how everyone else feels right now, but I think maybe I need to take a break. I guess that would maybe be the most difficult part. It was a very convoluted answer.
Yeah, I think that that's true, and especially it seems that people who follow baseball have personalities or interests that really lend themselves to baseball as a sport and to all that baseball entails, and that it's more of a thoughtful game. It requires, you know, a lot more analysis, a lot more poetic narrative to it. So I think that that's really kind of what draws a lot of us to baseball and what makes baseball maybe more of an easier sport for us to fall in love with.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, definitely. So on the flip side of all of that, in what ways has baseball positively impacted your life?
It has in every way at this point. It's a primary point of bonding for myself and my mom, for myself and my uncle too. It's a bonding point for bringing new people to my city, bringing them to Seattle and getting to show them the field, getting to watch a baseball game. That's one of the big things when I have visitors that I want to show them. It is, sorry, you can edit this part out as I'm trying to piece together my words. Yeah, I guess family is the big influence. My uncle had a stroke a few years back, and one of the first, so you start to slowly learn how to reverbalize. That's not a word, but you learn how to speak again, and you get that memory back. And one of the early exercises, my mom was sitting in his hospital room, going through the listing all of the teams in MLB, and she got through most of the American League teams and she got through most of the National League, but she forgot the Diamondbacks, and because they're an expansion team, she always forgets them. And it was one of the first times he was able to kind of engage with her, and he was able to like express that that was, she'd missed one, and they were able to look it back up, and it's the Diamondbacks. It's a very silly anecdote, I guess, but the way it weaves together generations is really powerful.
I don't think there was anything silly about that. I think that's really kind of amazing.
It goes to show
you can go, Jen.
Yeah, I was going to say, it just goes to show how intergenerational baseball can be and how, you know, it's been around for so long and it just keeps becoming a point of bonding for a lot of families.
Yeah, there's something very beautiful about it. That at its core, it's something that hasn't changed for so many years, and it means that it creates this very unique line, because you can have your 90-plus-year-old grandparents, they watch the exact same game that a 5-year-old is learning to watch now. Different variations, of course, but the game's still the same, and it's one of those lovely things too, where you can then go out together later and you can hold a baseball, you can throw a baseball, it's accessible.
And it just seems like a game that lends itself to starting conversations with people, and that of course goes a long way to helping people bond with friends that they've met on social media or with their family members.
Exactly. You don't watch a baseball game utterly silent. There's always an opportunity to engage in conversation, to high-five the people around you, or even if you're just watching at home. I don't know, I'll text my mom, I'll let her know what's going on, bemoan a recent injury, whatever it may be. It's, yeah, those conversations, they build up and become something very powerful.
They definitely do. And I hope that this conversation does a similar sort of thing for people. So you can follow Isabel on Twitter at 95 Coffee Spoons. And Isabel, we'd once again like to thank you for joining us today to talk about your relationship with baseball.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to hearing everyone else's stories.
Our next guest is Baseball Prospectus's Meg Rowley. Meg, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Anytime. So as we do with this segment, we start off with the guest's favorite team and how old they are, so the listener has an idea of who you are.
Sure. So my favorite team is the Houston Astros. No, I grew up a Mariners fan, so I am still technically a Mariners fan, and I am 31. So I was a fan early enough and long enough to enjoy the good years that make you want to stay a Mariners fan, and I can't decide if that's a very good or very bad thing.
So speaking about how long you've been a fan, what first made you interested in watching baseball?
Sure. So I actually became a baseball fan largely because of my stepmom. My great-grandpa on that side was a huge Mariners fan and just a big baseball fan in general. And Jane, my stepmom, really loves baseball. And so she would take us, I mean, we would kind of go as a family to games when they were still playing in the kingdom. So I kind of grew up with those late 90s Mariners teams where they were first plucky and then pretty good and then really good in the early 2000s. So that kind of cemented my fandom. And then just as I was sort of getting into the later part of my high school years and going away to the East Coast for college, they started being just a real bad baseball team. But I wasn't watching them every day, so it helped to maintain my fandom.
Well, you know, you are both a fan as well as a writer, and you are obviously pretty active on Twitter. That's, we all communicate with you through there. How would you say that writing about baseball, particularly with the advent of social media, has impacted your experience as a fan?
Well, I would say that you know, social media sort of didn't get me back into the game, but gave me a community around baseball when I was away from the sort of natural community that I might have. So I went to graduate school in Wisconsin, and it was really the first time since I had moved away from home that I had time to watch baseball every day and had sort of an hour back toward West Coast time, where doing that didn't mean that I was staying up till 2 a.m. and then having to get up to work a regular 9-to-5 job. So, you know, that would have been fun and sort of entertaining on its own, but Twitter sort of gave me a Mariners community to have access to. And then, you know, beyond that, there's sort of this whole ecosystem of Mariners blogs that really kind of connected me back to the team and to other Mariners fans. So it's funny, I think that sort of having that ready-made community made me more engaged with the game on a daily basis, and that engagement is in turn what sort of turned me to thinking that I might want to write about this. So, you know, as awful as Twitter can be sometimes, I think I owe a lot to the social media community that has sprung up around baseball, both in terms of finding people who have sort of kept me engaged in the game and have that same level of Mariner suffering, and then also, you know, has exposed writing of mine to people who are in positions to make hiring decisions in whatever capacity they can, and have given me access to bigger platforms. So, you know, Twitter is the worst, but I wouldn't have any kind of writing career without it. So it's sort of this weird deal with the devil that I, along with I think many other people, have made.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that, and I think we all can to some extent. So what's the most difficult thing about being a baseball fan?
I mean, like, the team I like loses a lot. They lose all the time. I mean, that's not fair. They have been significantly better in the last, say, couple of years than they have been when I was living in New York, and would sort of wake up very early East Coast time and look at the box score from the night before and be like, God damn it, how did they lose again? I mean, Felix was starting, you guys. You should win those. So they're better than they have been. But, you know, I think that losing is good for sports fans, because, you know, when people win all the time, they're kind of the worst. And I think that having a perspective on the stuff within the game that is not just about winning is really valuable, because it makes you appreciate a lot of the really lovely and interesting things that baseball has to offer. But it is kind of a bummer when every October features somebody else. I mean, like, I've spent at this point more than half my life without the Mariners in the playoffs, and now Shohei Ohtani is an Angel, so that might continue for a little while into the future. So that part is hard. But the other thing that I think has sort of emerged as a challenge in the last couple of years is, and I think this isn't, you know, a unique observation on my part or something that's unique to me, but when you're writing about baseball that isn't just the team that you cover, you know, you start to lose a little bit of the sort of immediate emotional attachment to the team that you grew up rooting for, not because you don't care about them as much in a way that's purposeful, but just because you're thinking about other things and caring about other stuff and worrying about other stuff. So I think at this particular moment, apart from the sadness, being a fan at all is kind of hard in a small way, because, you know, like, I have my list of things that I'm ready to write about in the next couple of weeks, and none of them involve the Mariners, at least not until Jerry DePoto does something crazy at winter meetings. So I think at this point in my writing career, kind of being a fan is the difficult part of being a fan. So they should make the playoffs and see if that changes stuff, like, as an experiment, like, in dedication to science. I think that they should just do that, and we can see what change that brings.
I think that would be great. And I think we were all kind of rooting for, well, you know, in Sarah's case, if it wasn't going to be the Dodgers, we were all rooting for him to, for Ohtani to go to the Mariners. So that was also kind of a little bit of a difficult thing for us to see, just because we know so many Mariners fans.
Yeah.
But we really we're rooting for you guys to have a little bit of joy for a while.
Yeah, it would have been cool. But, I mean, I don't know. If I were a young baseball wunderkind and I had made the decision to care about stuff that wasn't my contract, I don't know, I'd probably want to play with Mike Trout, too.
That's
so. Yeah, but the flip side of that is you have to live in Anaheim, so.
Well, or you have to drive to Anaheim.
True.
Which is,
and that's no fun
terrible
either.
In its own right, but yeah, it's a bummer. I mostly feel bad for the folks I know who are in the organization. I know that it was just a real tough beat for them and a bad loss, and I don't know what else they could have done except have the best player in baseball, and, you know, there wasn't much they could do about making that happen, so it's just a bummer, but it'll be fun to see him over here anyway. I guess I'm going to watch more Angels games. That's weird.
Yeah, that's going to be very weird, I think, for the entire baseball community to be focused on the Angels again.
Yeah, people are going to learn all about Cole Calhoun and how he spells his first name with a K and how that makes no sense. So other people are going to get familiar with that. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to the perplexity and the anger that will furnish in a lot of people that have not been currently aware of that fact, because it's one that's bugged me for a while.
Doesn't make any sense. Makes no sense. I have a younger brother. His name is Cole. He spells it with a C, like a normal person. What's up, Cole Calhoun? Anyhow. That's the other difficult thing about being a fan. Cole Calhoun.
Cole. Yeah, it's like you want to, like, spoonerize people's names and, like...
It just makes it another name. Another normal name.
Yeah, but it's like you swap the letters, but, like, it's pronounced exactly the same.
Absolutely.
Like, that's... I guess you could call him Cal Calhoun, but...
Yeah, I guess.
I think that's taking it a little too far. Anyway,
I feel like baseball, either, like, it has a broad spectrum. It either has phenomenal names or just, like, the worst names that could possibly exist. And there's, like, not a lot of in-between.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that we appreciate, like, some of the weirdness around middle names as much as we could. Like, Kyle Seager's middle name is Dewar. D-U-E-R-R. That's a name. That's a name that he has on his birth certificate.
What?
Yeah.
Today I learned.
Today you learned. It has to be a family name, right? That has to be something that he's, like, doing, and he and his wife are doing in honor of a person they know.
Yeah.
That could be. Corey's middle name is just Drew. That's, like, a normal person
name.
That's,
like, a normal name.
Yeah.
Does Kyle Seager have, like, weird names? Like, in the rest of his family, isn't there something?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know how weird we want to call them, but he and his wife have two adorable blonde children, so that's fun for him. But they have kind of funny names. Now I'm kind of forgetting what they are.
I think one of them is named Crew.
Yes, but spelled funny. That was
the
thing.
Not that.
Yeah, the name's, that's a name. That's a normal. I know another person named Crew. But and then their daughter's name is Remy with a Y, which is kind of a cute name. I'm fine with that. I mean, they're not my kids. They get to name their kids whatever they want. And they're very cute. But those are their names.
And, I feel like I learned a lot today.
Justin,
I had no idea.
Justin Seager's middle name is Ryan, so.
So why did they do that? Like, they, like, gave the two of their kids perfectly normal names, and then the other, like, gave them, like, the weirdest middle name possible. That's just mean.
I mean, his first name is Kyle, which is a pretty normal name, so.
And no one ever needed to know necessarily, but. I mean, we're talking about it on a podcast right now, so.
Well, that's part of that's some of the risk when you bring me on, I suppose.
I feel like I looked it up one day and it's some family name. Like,
yeah. Probably.
I can't
probably
remember
so.
What one. So I'm going to have to relook it up.
It's it's fine. They have a beautiful baseball family. Good for them.
Yeah. Speaking about more positive things. I'm really good at transitioning, in case you didn't know.
It was very smooth.
Thank you. So in addition to kind of creating a community and providing you with a platform on which to write about things, is there any other way that being a baseball fan has positively impacted your life?
I think we shouldn't underestimate how nice it is to have something to listen to in the summer months when you're making dinner or doing laundry. It's nice to have sort of things you care about that have a pleasant sound to them, sort of filling up the background of nice summer days. So that's nice. But I just have these like really lovely friends I've met through baseball and baseball writing. I think when you become an adult person, it becomes harder to make new friends because you're not in school and you don't necessarily want to see the people you work with on a Saturday. So making new adult friends can be kind of tricky, and you end up having to retell like a lot of your life to strangers, and then you do this weird thing where you decide if those stories are interesting enough to like keep chatting with one another. And baseball kind of gives you a common vocabulary to get through some of that. So you know that you have a thing in common. You might not think about the game the same way or appreciate it in the same way. And that can, lead to just sort of a passing friendship versus something that's more serious and long term. But I think, it gives you this really great opportunity to meet people who have a common interest and who really want to do the same stuff. And that's a really lovely thing, especially as you're becoming like an adult person, because you don't always have that opportunity otherwise. So I like that part. That part's cool.
That's definitely a good part. And I think, a lot of people get the same thing from baseball and from social media, including the three of us.
Yeah. It's nice. It's good to know when to like go outside. It's good to go outside away from that stuff too. But, if you're going to spend your inside time doing anything, that's not a bad thing to spend it doing. So,
yeah, absolutely. So thank you again, Meg, for coming on for this episode. You can follow Meg at Meg Rowler on Twitter. Meg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Our final guest of the day is someone we had on as a guest in week 11. She's a sports and culture columnist at Bitch Media with bylines at tons of other places, including Hardball Times. She's Brittany Della Creta. Brittany, how's it going?
Hi, it's going great. How are you guys?
Doing all right.
We're good.
All right, so let's just dive right into this. And for each guest, just to kind of get a sense of where they're coming from in terms of fandom, we'd like for you to give us your age and your favorite teams.
So I am 32 for another like 3 days, and my favorite teams are the Red Sox because I am based in Boston, and also I am one of like 12 Marlins fans, so that's fun.
This has been a week for people who like the Marlins.
It's been 20 years for people who like the Marlins.
True, but like it somehow keeps getting worse. Like it doesn't seem like it can, but it does.
It does.
Well, on that note, what first got you interested in watching baseball?
So I grew up watching baseball with my dad. My dad played minor league baseball. He played single A for the St. Louis farm system, and so I would watch baseball games with him at night when he got home from work. And he taught me about the game, and my dad and I are very different people. We have basically nothing in common. So throughout the years, the one thing that we've been able to talk about is baseball. And so that's a thing that's always connected me to my dad. And so it was a really important part of my life for that reason. And then I moved to Boston in 2003. Which was a really great year to be a Boston fan, until Game 7 of the ALCS. But it was really exciting, and so I sort of got swept up again in baseball because, you know, the next year they won their first World Series in, like, a million years. So it was just a really great time to be a baseball fan in Boston, and so that kind of reignited the passion I already had for the sport.
So how would you say social media has impacted your experience as a fan and a writer?
I don't know what it would be like to be a writer without social media, because it connected me with so many other writers, and not just writers, but editors. And my work gets shared, and so people then approach me to write for them because they've seen my work. So I feel like I get to reach a lot more people and establish a voice as well, which I think helps a lot. And being a fan, it kind of works similarly in that I connect with a lot of other fans, and I am not someone who has had a lot of other, particularly like women in my life who have liked baseball. Everyone I've always bonded over baseball with has been men, and that's fine. That's great. I still talk to lots of guys about baseball, but the online community has helped me find and connect with a ton of women and non-binary fans, which is amazing. Honestly, it's really been validating for me as a person, because I've spent so long not really knowing anybody who was like me, and who had that interest. And so it's just a really nice thing to like feel seen and also to feel like you're not this like weird outlier.
On the side of things, what is the most difficult thing about being a fan, as well as the most difficult thing about being a writer?
So being a fan, I guess we'll go back to the Marlins. It's like, especially when you're a Marlins fan, it's super heartbreaking. And that's something I've always loosely followed the team. They're my hometown team, but I already kind of had a fandom by the time they came around, since they were not a team until 93. But over the last few seasons, it's been something that I've really decided to follow the team again and to really get to know who they are and how they got to where they are as a franchise. And I guess what I would just say is that it's really heartbreaking. And so every time I feel like I am at peace with the fact that I love this team, I'm just like the rug is pulled out from under me all over again. So I think being a fan, like I'd say that that's sort of been the hardest thing for me. And being a writer, I would say that it's convincing editors that stories about women in sports or women in baseball are worth telling. It's really hard to find. So I freelance, right, and I write all these different places. But because of that, I'm at the mercy of freelance budgets. And so they have to decide that they want to spend their budget on a women in sports or a women in baseball story. And with women's publications, it's really hard to convince them that women care about sports. And so I might get like one byline and then not for another year, because it's like, oh, just did that one story on women in sports. And on the flip side, with sports publications, a lot of them, there's hardly any women's coverage. So it's in this, because I specialize in women and sports, it's this weird little niche that doesn't really fit neatly into any kind of genre of publication. And so it's sort of always a fight of convincing whatever editor it is that it's a story worth telling and that there's an audience for that story.
Well, then on the other side of the coin, what would you say has been the positive impact of being a fan and being a baseball writer?
Well, I've met so many amazing people. I think that's just, you know, I talked about that earlier, but the people that are in my life as a result of doing this work, especially in a digital space, is amazing. So the support I get from my friends and the people that I'm connected with is really great. And I think also I'm doing things I never thought I would ever do. I'm profiling like my idols. Like I spent the day with Jessica Mendoza at Fenway Park, and I got to interview Claire Smith. And then I got to write about them for like Vogue. And you know, Teen Vogue and ESPNW and these just, if you would have told me as a kid that I was hanging out with people like this and writing for publications like that, I never would have believed that that was possible. So there's a little bit of this, is this really my life? Like, I still get excited about bylines and I still am like totally nerding out when I land a really cool interview or assignment. And so I just feel really, really lucky that this is what I get to do, like, for a job.
Yeah, it's definitely really cool, and I think we all here agree that you do a really amazing job with it, and we always, you know, look forward to new stuff coming from you. So keep up the great work.
Thank you.
You can follow Brittany on Twitter at BrittanyDLC. That's Brittany spelled B-R-I-T-N-I. Brittany, thanks for coming back. It's always great talking with you.
Yeah, same. Have a great, I guess, weekend. That's when we're recording. So have a great your weekend.
Thank you too. And now the past week's articles. Mary?
All right. Thank you, Jen. So on Monday, we have Evaluating Talent Distribution on Rosters by John LaRue. In wake of a discussion of MLB super teams, John evaluates whether it's better for a team to possess depth but no superstars or the reverse, using WAR or WPA in the case of relievers in relation to percentage of games played per player since 1988. The piece analyzes playing time distribution according to five categories, ranging from deep teams to deep teams with stars. If you want to know what kind of team is the best, you'll have to read the piece, though. And then on Tuesday, we had A Special Revenge for Louis Tiant by Alfonso Tissa. In the winter of 1971, Louis Tiant went to play in the Venezuelan Winter League, despite how poorly Tiant had played due to an arm injury that season. Alfonso tells the story of a drive he took with his father and mother on November 14th of that year while listening to Tiant's no-hitter on the radio and explaining the significance of the game to his father. This piece is a great look at Venezuela, Tiant, and the role that baseball plays in creating family bonds.
All right, then on Wednesday we have If You Vote for Omar Vizquel, You Have to Vote for Jamie Moyer by Nathaniel Rakic. While the title provides a pretty succinct summary of the author's arguments, the details are interesting. One of the key components of the Hall of Fame case for Vizquel is his longevity, while Moyer's career lasted even longer. Nathaniel also notes that when you adjust their numbers for the eras in which they played, Moyer comes out looking much better than Vizquel. This is just a couple of the points that Nathaniel raises, but really it's not even so much about these two individual players as it is the standards that we set for ourselves with our Hall of Fame choices. Then on Thursday and Friday, we had the Hardball Times franchise player draft. On Thursday was the intro on picks 1 through 2. Then Friday was picks 3 through 5. It's the first two installments of the Hardball Times 2018 franchise player draft, in which THT contributors pick current players around which they would choose to build their team. And I'm not going to spoil the picks for you, except for the first one. The first one is Mike Trout, because of course it's Mike Trout. That shouldn't even qualify as a spoiler, because how could it be anyone other than Mike Trout? But besides that, read the articles to see the subsequent picks and to decide how much you agree or disagree with them. I know that I personally was sort of surprised by picks 4 and 5. You can see if you feel the same way.
So for the next couple of weeks, the articles are going to be the franchise player draft picks. Next week, we'll be getting through picks 6 through 20. Two of our guests today, Isabel and Brittany, make an appearance in there, as well as our own Mary Craig. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at @SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at @MaryMCraig, and you can find the podcast on Twitter @THTAudio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.